Welcome to Coffee with Catholic Workers, a podcast made by and for Catholic workers. I'm Theo.
And I'm Lydia. We've both been a part of the Catholic Worker for the last decade or so, and we're excited to bring to you conversations with different Catholic workers around the world.
Today we're kicking off the first of a three-part series on labor. The Catholic Worker newspaper was first published on May Day, a significant date for the labor movement. In our first interview, we talk with Rosalie Regal, an oral historian who has published several books about the Catholic Worker movement. Rosalie shares with us some of the historical context of the Catholic Worker, as well as some of the intersections that Dorothy Day had with the labor movement of her time.
So we'll link to some of Rosalie's books in our podcast notes for people to check out later, but we'll go ahead and get to the interview now. Maybe to start out, Rosalie, do you want to introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about who you are for maybe people who aren't aware?
Well, I'm Rosalie Regal. I'm a longtime Catholic worker, but I have to tell you, I met Dorothy Day 20 years before I became a Catholic worker. I think she was coming back from the trial of the Milwaukee 14. Her good friend Michael Cullen was in that. And she stopped in Saginaw, Michigan to visit some Catholic workers there. And one of them took me down to meet her. She didn't pay much attention to us. She was tired. Just a scraggly bunch of hippies in 1969. And wasn't a very long meeting. She didn't talk or anything. She just shook her hands and then she went and sat down and we maybe had some. She talked to this small African-American woman, or listened to her actually, who was doing this program to help women with children that were on food stamps. And, you know, Dorothy was always just really interested in little things that were being done for good. So she listened to her. And then afterwards, my friend, who was my his whole life till he died in 2012, took me back to his bookstore, loaded me down with books. And I came home probably about 7:30. And there was a note from my husband. He said, I've taken the children to McDonald's, the daughters of a woman who's too busy feeding a hungry world, or some nasty thing like that. So I had to make a decision, and I decided to stay there, to stay with my family, to not pursue Catholic worker. And it was years later before I really became interested in it, when I wrote my way into the worker with my first book, doing an oral history of the movement. It was published in 93. And then I wrote another book about Dorothy and a couple more oral histories of men and women who had protested nonviolently for peace. So that was how I came into the movement. Got to know everybody.
And your books are really sort of this seminal piece now of ways that people learn about and hear about the Catholic Worker. I don't remember if you remember, but we worked on a project together when we were doing some of the oral histories and recordings of one of the protests for the Faith and Resistance retreat.
Oh, I remember that. Sure. It was after the Faith and Resistance retreat in Minnesota, I think. And we worked on those. I still edit things. I like to edit.
And you actually had this sort of foreshadowing of this podcast. Of you actually had suggested, like, we should save these recordings because, like, it would be really neat to be able to edit them and have them, like, available. And it was a really good idea. It just happened to be, like, you know, 5 or 6 years later that Theo and I finally got around to being like, oh, maybe we should have a podcast as this sort of continuation of these histories of the Catholic Worker.
Yeah. Well, that resistance retreat really changed me so much as far as how I approach nonviolent resistance I used to just be so quiet and kneeling down all the time and all this namby-pamby stuff. And now I've learned to kind of yell and shout and things. I realize that shouting doesn't necessarily mean violence.
Maybe we should have Chris edit those together for a special podcast mini-series or something like that, if they still exist.
Well, we could do that. I'm like, you know, they're long. So I think they're a little too long. I know mine was.
It would take some editing.
Yeah. I'm actually much better at editing other people's stuff than I am my own.
Well, Rosalie, one of the things we wanted to talk with you about, given your history of being an oral historian for the Catholic Worker, was some of the founding of the Catholic Worker. Could you talk a little bit about why the Catholic Worker was founded specifically on May 1st, and what was the significance of that?
Well, Dorothy chose May 1st because it was International Workers' Day. May 1st has always been a day for celebration, for celebrating new life in spring. And so I think it was in 1884 or something that a group founded International Workers' Day. And later on, Grover Cleveland changed. He was suspicious of communist influence in that. So he changed the U.S. to Labor Day in September as our Workers' Day. But when Dorothy, in 1933, Dorothy thought May Day was the perfect time to introduce the Catholic Worker newspaper, which they went out to Union Square and started selling on the streets on that day in 1933.
Yeah, and I mean, in her own way, Dorothy and Peter talked about like countering communist influence or something, but they were trying to bring like this Catholic Worker paper out too.
Well, I think it was called Catholic, partly because at that time, not maybe not so much anymore, but at that time, most people who came to the Catholic Worker were Catholic. And from the get-go, from the fact that from when she was a teenager, she'd been impassioned with working for the laboring class and bettering their good, making their lives better. And she wrote about that during what I call her wandering years, when she lived in Chicago and University of Illinois and New York, and wrote for The Call and The Liberator and The Masses. It was Floyd Bell that kind of told her how to be an editor. Anyway, but she was always going to leftist radical meetings, always identifying with the poor, even though at that time she was not really identifying at all with the Catholic Church.
Even before she founded the Catholic Worker, she had been heavily involved with the labor movement. Could you talk a little bit about some of the work she really focused on in that?
Yeah, she was working for The Call, which was a socialist newspaper, I believe, magazine, and then The Masses. And then I think later the Liberator, they were shut down for communist influence. There was a lot of censorship in those days. And I didn't have any of those books down here. But I remember there's an anthology of work that she wrote before she started the Catholic Worker. But in the very first issue on May 1st, 1933, there was an article about African-American laborers down south. The second issue, they talked about a farmer strike in the Midwest and about the horrible conditions of the restaurant workers in the cities. And in the third issue, the Catholic Worker newspaper, they talked about textile strikes and child labor. In the fourth issue, they talked about coal and milk strikes, and they moved to international issues as well. And they were criticized for joining with the communists and picketing the German consulate for anti-Semitism. You know, this is one of the things she really disagreed with, so much of the hierarchy of the church, which she had joined after Tamar was born. The fact that communists championed the cause of black people didn't mean to have, that Catholics should have to stay away. So she would join picketing, I think it was Orlach's department store strike. And she wrote that the police were taken aback seeing the word Catholic in picket signs when they load them into their paddy wagons.
So the paper was always supporting these workers' movements and stuff like that, but the Catholic workers themselves like started getting active and supporting strikes and different actions like that, right? Can you tell us about some of those?
Well, the good sisters would let their students come down to support workers picketing religious prosecution, but they wouldn't let their students support strikers. And the Brooklyn Tablet was always, that was a Catholic newspaper, was always publishing things criticizing her. But that didn't mean that she stopped supporting unions. The National Maritime Union, they supported them in 1936. And then the next year they rented a place on 10th Avenue and used it as a kind of a soup kitchen, rest and recuperation place for the seamen strikers. And that's when Joe Hughes joined the Catholic worker from the Seamen Maritime Union. And he was the father of Joanna Hughes Turner, who was so important, such an important friend of mine over the years, and helped me so much in transcribing so many of my interviews for the book. But I think one of the real turning points for her, and I didn't learn this for years, was she went to Flint, Michigan in the very month I was born there. And she wrote about it in the March 1937 issue of the Catholic Worker. She had a really ironic title, I think. And I can't believe she was in Flint the year I was born. She wrote about it as a small town with not very many paved streets. Well, that wasn't the small town I knew. I didn't think it was small. I lived in a really nice house by a park, and the streets were certainly paved. She wrote the essay about this. The title was CW Editor Calls Upon GM Strikers in Plant in Flint. Very erotic, calls upon. She climbed in through a window. They had a little stool thing. And because so many of the newspaper in the strikers inside knew her paper, she didn't have any trouble getting in Fisher Body Plant number 1, which was the site of the huge sit-down strike. And she spent the day in there. And I don't know whether people know this, but there are some people that go around combing Dorothy's writing to see if she has any instances when she was nonviolent. She was not nonviolent. And they count this as one of them, because these strikers had amassed weapons, clubs and things, in case they were attacked by the Pinkertons. When she came down, she was brought down by a fellow named Orr, I think, and climbed in the window. She talked about the National Guard being there and their bayonets and machine guns and everything. And I think she thought that they were guarding the people outside against the strikers. It was the other way around. Governor Murphy of Michigan was Catholic. She later interviewed him. And he had ordered the National Guard to protect the strike. So, I mean, it was just a very militant thing. And they weren't attacked from inside. And eventually, strike was ended. Somebody called it the strike. The BBC called it the strike heard around the world. The National Labor Relations Act was passed the year afterwards. And actually, Governor Murphy was really, really important to mediate the agreement. And so the UAW was recognized by General Motors. And then its membership increased from, I got this from some history, from 30,000 to 500,000 members because of this strike heard around the world. But the fact that that happened when I was, the year I was born, was just amazing. My father was a staunch conservative, very anti-union, and I didn't hear about that for years and years. So that was really something, was such a coincidence.
Another interesting historical example of the workers working with striking labor was they actually sided with labor against the Archdiocese of New York, right? During a gravedigger strike?
Yeah. They went out and tried to stop that. The Archdiocese was trying to get the seminarians to dig the graves. Be scabs, basically. And the Catholic workers went out, I think it was 1949, and tried to persuade the seminarians not to do that. They were supporting the gravediggers' strike. She eventually kind of lost faith, at least in the big unions. I mean, she loved the IWW when she was a child. And she was very excited when the CIO and the AFL were recognized, but she realized that they supported their workers, but they didn't have the big picture thing. Peter Morin, who, if it hadn't been for Peter Morin, I don't think there'd be a Catholic worker, but he always told her to look at the big picture. He didn't always look at the little picture. He didn't like strikes. He disagreed with her and the Catholic workers supporting strikers. He said, strikes don't strike me. He wanted the big picture of medieval craft farms and fields.
Yeah, I suppose that is a piece of tension of this idea of when the Catholic worker and Peter Morin's vision is this giant societal shift of the tension between, okay, do we improve what we have now versus do we try to completely change the entire outlook and structure of everything?
Yeah. Well, you know, one interesting Catholic worker, an article about him, I think the first article about him was in the same March 1937 issue, was the Catholic worker John Court, who founded the Association of Catholic Trade Unionists in March 1937 at the Catholic Worker. And a lot of people looked at that as just a way to sort of conquer the communist influence in the worker. But he had a bigger picture than that. He wanted the ACTU to, as he told me in 1988 when I interviewed him, educate, stimulate, and coordinate on a Christian basis the action of Catholic working men and women in the labor movement. And they used the principles from the great encyclicals of Leo XIII and Pius XI, the things that Peter Morin had introduced Dorothy to. And this WACTU was to work constructively, not negatively, along Catholic lines. And it was open to all workers, whether they've joined a union or not. Whereas a union, you know, you had to be a member, and the unions advocated for their members, not for the good of all workers.
Yeah, and I mean, the one thing about the Catholic worker is it does advocate for, like, a change in the worker's relationship to the means of production, really. You know, it advocates dispersal of private property or productive property and worker co-ops and stuff like that, too.
Yeah, I think John Cort that wrote that capitalism is by its nature not democratic, it's oligarchical. And they only negotiate out of a position of strength. And the ACTU lasted till the late 60s. At one time, it had 60 chapters, but they did worker schools. The Jesuits also did these labor schools to give workers training in organizing, public speaking, parliamentary law, that kind of thing that they needed to become good communicators. And they, you know, like my father taught unions were communist. And the ACTU tried to say, no, unions aren't communist. They may be socialist in their tradition of working for the good, but they were not communist.
It seems like the worker, although it had this really strong focus on labor starting out, sort of shifted some of the emphasis of focus more towards peace movements than labor. Why do you think some of the focus on labor decreased somewhat over time?
Well, I think it's because we used to say labor pressed its pants. Labor became capitalist and corporatist, big labor, UAW, EFL-CIO, you know, they became powerful and uncaring of the non-unionized workers. Whereas Dorothy was, from the time she was 15, by the time she read Upton Sinclair and was walking around with her baby brother John in a stroller in Chicago, she knew that the plight of the poor was to be the driving focus of her life. And then, of course, she realized that supporting war harmed the poor. And over the years, especially after the Second World War, I think the worker became more known for its pacifism and for promoting a return to the early Gospels and the first years of the church before it became beholden to Caesar. So she always had her problems with the hierarchy. What was that Guardini quote? The church is the cross upon which Christ is crucified. She used to quote that a lot, because the hierarchy of the church depended on wealthy people to support it. And were traditionally, most of them, not every bishop, but most of them, weren't supportive of labor. She did know the ones that were, and she worked with the lay people that were. But there was always that tension between both labor and the church and poverty in the church and pacifism.
So what else, Rosalie, should we know about labor and the Catholic worker, or the Catholic worker and its relationship to labor and work?
Well, I think one of the things we need to remember is that Dorothy's last arrest was in support of farm workers who were boycotting lettuce and other crops. She first went to California in 69 to work with Cesar Chavez. I think they shared the same doctor. I've forgotten her name. But she worked for Cesar Chavez too. And then in August of 1973, Dorothy was arrested out in the fields in California for the last time with the United Farm Workers, and she spent 2 weeks at a prison farm. I think the archive still has the green dress that she was given her when she left. It was signed by all the people that she was in prison with, including Catherine Morris of the Los Angeles Catholic Worker. And she had a lot of visitors. It was a fairly good prison camp. And she'd sit outside and all these farm worker wives, not farm worker wives, so farm owner wives would come and say, oh, you know, our husbands are such good Catholics. And she said, well, then why don't they give justice to their workers? And finally, Chavez was able to prevail, and a lot of the workers are organized. But I don't think the Catholic Worker seems at all interested in labor issues now. Maybe somebody knows more about it than I do.
Is that a failing, in your opinion? Like, do you think we should be more involved in that?
Well, it seems to me the people that we should be working with, and I think a lot of Catholic worker houses are the undocumented immigrants who come in and who are so, it used to be really important in Michigan, probably still is. You know, they'd work all summer, and then their workers would sometimes turn them in at the end of the summer. So I think that would be a wonderful issue for the Catholic worker houses to really become involved in. There is a new union movement of trying to organize faculty, for instance. That was the only union work I ever was involved in, was trying to organize the part-time faculty when I was teaching part-time. And I think Dorothy at one time supported Fordham strikers who were trying to unionize secretaries and adjunct faculties and were being fought on every thing. So that was another thing we had in common. And actually, when I started a Catholic worker house in Saginaw, Michigan in 1987, and I had a student who did an internship there, and then she went to New York for spring break, and Carmen Trotta got a hold of her, and she stayed. She went back and graduated, and then she went back to New York and worked for years. And then when I last heard from her, she was working to unionize adjunct faculty, because that's one of the great ununionized areas of U.S. culture, along with the immigrant labor.
Well, thanks for talking to us, Rosalie. Did you have any other questions or thoughts, either of you?
Okay. Well, I hope you have people that are more active in individual houses now. I've become active recently with the St. Francis House in Chicago because it's had sort of a renaissance. But they're working on neighborhood issues more than labor issues. It doesn't seem to be a huge Chicago push. Immigrant issues are. But, you know, during the days of Dorothy Day, Chicago was very important in the strikers, not so much.
Yeah, it is interesting. We talked with Joe Cruz about some of his push in organizing, but a lot of that was more individual, right, rather than as much house-based. I'm trying to think of, didn't Matt Harper support and the LA workers support some union stuff out there? But beyond that, those are the only things I know of houses that have really supported things.
Good. Yeah. Well, I mean, one of the lovely and lasting things about the Catholic worker is you don't wait for somebody in a big house or in New York to do it. If you see a problem, you address it. And Dorothy started doing that, you know, as a teenager working when she became a leftist radical. She was always very American. If you see something, do something. And if whether it's feeding peanut butter sandwiches or apple butter sandwiches to the striking seamen or picketing against seminarian scabs, you do something about what's happening in your area. And that's one of the glories of the Catholic worker today, is that they act locally.
Well, thanks, Rosalie, for spending this morning with us and sharing your wealth of knowledge. We definitely appreciate it.
Well, a lot of it was just research, except for that part about being born the same month that Dorothy was in Flint, and then meeting her years later when I had four little kids and waiting so long before I became active in the Catholic worker. The rest of it was just stuff I looked up and read in Long Loneliness and in John Lowry's good biography. So I did quite a bit of research, and it was just really exciting for me to see how important she was and all the traveling around she did in for the plight of the laboring working class.
Thanks again to Rosalie for taking the time to talk with us. It's always fun to hear these intro to the Catholic worker stories, and Rosalie had all these like near Catholic worker misses so many times in her life. We're lucky we finally got her to join up there later on.
Yeah, Rosalie has a very interesting perspective, both coming at some of this from coming from academia of teaching at universities, but also this like rich history of just being so well versed in Catholic worker history, both past and present. So she references in our interview this article about Dorothy Day, about the strike that she went in and viewed, or I guess joined. And so I'm going to read a quote from that article by Dorothy Day. So Dorothy says, "The sit-down strike has been used as a nonviolent tactic to prevent scabs from taking the jobs of the worker and to prevent the employer from removing the machinery and thus depriving the worker of his right to work and earn a living. We of the Catholic worker have upheld it. Though the sit-down strike is a nonviolent method tactic, the men were ready to repel the efforts to evict them. And during the 41 days of their siege, they had fashioned themselves clubs which hung at their belts, and there were boxes of heavy hinges and bolts ready to be used as missiles. These were their arms, and their preparations seemed pitifully inadequate to me in view of the machine guns and riot guns of the militia and the guards of the companies."
Yeah, I had read that article not long before talking to Rosalie, and again, that was one of her interesting moments of like the Catholic worker coming close to touching her life. That Dorothy Day was climbing in that window at the Flint factory right when Rosalie was being born, kind of thing. But I thought it was really interesting to hear Dorothy Day speak about these workers literally arming themselves as part of their strike effort. I think it paints Dorothy's nonviolence in a more interesting way than a lot of people today might talk about it. Like, imagine some of the uproar that might happen if we were talking about workers at like a Walmart arming themselves to repel the National Guard from the outside. You know, I think that there's a lot of people who would question that, but in that same article, she talks about, like, not only are we a Catholic paper, we're a labor paper as well. So, like, she very much saw the cause of the workers as the cause of the Catholic worker newspaper, and was siding with labor, even though they used some of these tactics to defend themselves.
There is this interesting phrase used in that article that pops out to me, the idea of, like, right to work. And thinking about the way that that phrase has been twisted now to mean something else as we think about, like, right to work labor laws, which are used in restrictive ways in states. And so it's kind of interesting to see it here, sort of remembering that labor, and particularly in these situations here, it was sort of this, like, do or die, life or death type situation of, like, workers needing to work to make a living, to be able to exist. And the weight of elevating that idea beyond, I think sometimes it's easy to feel like, oh, people are just wanting, I don't know, these extra things that aren't important. When really it's in many ways like this fight for existence.
Yeah, that's a huge part, I think, of the Catholic worker thought on labor as we're having these conversations, is that, like, positive right to work. We're going to talk to Lincoln about Peter's, you know, some of his Green Revolution agrarian stuff. That's in itself kind of a right to work thing. Like, the land will always pay you is kind of part of Peter's thought. And we see again and again, like, capitalism, like, that doesn't respect that right to work. As we're talking, you know, in recent months, the Federal Reserve keeps raising interest rates with, like, the explicit purpose of increasing unemployment, you know, to combat inflation is what they say. Like, the capitalist government is, like, literally attacking that, like, right to work. And it just comes up again and again. And that's why I think, you know, the Catholic worker puts so much emphasis on, like, changing the relationship to the means of production for, like, the workers. Like, capitalism was doing it back in Dorothy Day's time, denying people the right to work, and they're still doing it today. And until we get rid of that acquisitive society, as Peter calls it, for something more functional, it's probably just going to keep happening.
I think there's also a sense where it's become so normalized that sometimes we don't realize how strange it is. Because it's hard to think that, like, there have been societies that never functioned like this, and that this is really, in world history, sort of a new way of functioning, this ability to acquire sort of these endless mountains of wealth that people can never actually use in their lifetimes. And yet that's now, like, the end goal, the end ideal of one's life and career.
Yeah. Peter Morin has this phrase that the bank account has become the standard of values. And it's really true. It's kind of become the only consideration. Like, is it profitable? Can somebody be making money off of it? And that includes going back to that, like, right to work. If it's more profitable to close a factory or something, even if they're already making a profit, if they could make more profit, they will do it. And, you know, the consideration for those workers is not even really part of the equation. A phrase Rosalie used that I don't know if I'd heard elsewhere, but it really struck me from our conversation, was that labor pressed its pants, that it's become like a professional institution now. And I think as Catholic workers, you know, who kind of shun that institutionalization and whatnot, it is, like, an interesting warning, I think, of, like, some of the dangers. Again, I'm not trying to put down organized labor or workers collecting their power to fight for better conditions or anything like that. But that strike that Rosalie was talking about, and we read a little bit of Dorothy's report on, you know, those workers were militant. Like you said earlier, that it was a life and death thing. It's how they were going to feed their family. But it's rare to see that kind of action in today's labor world.
Yeah, it is interesting. There is this piece where, and I wonder if we might in our next episode of this series with Lincoln kind of feel this out a little bit more, where Peter was not so into this organized labor. Because I think there is this sense where organized labor does operate within the current paradigm. And so it can't really be free of some of the same things that pull down these like values of capitalism to begin with. And here in Chicago, there's several very large unions, and a lot of them do really good work in protecting people. And there's also some of the same dynamics at play of politicking and this endless desire for acquiring things that sort of plagues corporations. And so I think there's that tension of both unions and organized labor do wonderful work in furthering the plight of exploited workers, and they're also not creating that new society that Peter dreams of.
All very true. I can't wait till next time when we talk about all of those things with our friend Lincoln Rice.
Well, that wraps up for us another episode of Coffee with Catholic Workers. If you want to reach out to us with comments, suggestions, clarification of thought, you can email us at coffeewithcatholicworkers@gmail.com. We want to thank Chris from the Bloomington Catholic Worker for help with editing, David Hayes for our music, and Becky McIntyre for our graphic.
We hope this conversation has been enlightening for you, and that maybe you're even inspired to go out and create a world where it's a little bit easier to be good.